We've all heard the saying, only if these walls could talk. Do you ever wonder what it's really like to be at a crime scene? What it feels like? How it smells? Hi, I'm Gabrielle, and I'm going to take you on a journey of real crime scene investigation. With over 12 years of professional experience in CSI, I will be sharing stories involving sex, lies, and murder. I trust you will enjoy. And remember, the walls do talk. Hello and welcome to the True Crime Podcast, The Walls Do Talk. I am your host, Gabrielle Weimer, and I'm so excited for you all to be here with me today. The reason I'm excited is because I have a very, very special guest here with me today. I have the wonderful, talented Kayla Hanna. Kayla, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. All right. So a little bit about Kayla, everybody, so you get to know her before we pop off with this episode. Kayla is a crime scene investigator from Southern California. She's been in law enforcement for 10 years, and she's actively doing CSI. And she's been actively doing CSI since 2017. But lo and behold, she's done everything from dispatch to records, traffic, and before landing her dream job, she did all that before landing her dream job. And like the rest of us out there that are crime scene investigators, it does seem like a long-ass journey to get here. But once you're here, it's absolutely amazing, and it goes so fast. So I was doing a little bit of research about you and asking around, and I came across a very interesting fact. You know, as a very quirky fact, and I feel like a lot of us are kind of quirky and have some weird stuff about us, but I heard that you used to own and operate a pet cemetery with your parents. Is this true?
100% true. Yes.
All right, girl. Okay, because, I mean, my family had a pet cemetery, but it was my grandma's backyard, you know? We had a lot of dogs and cats back there. Please tell me and the listeners, what the heck does it mean to own and operate a pet cemetery?
Well, so we were looking to get out of Washington State, and this opportunity came up. It was actually my dad's uncle's business, and they were getting older. Okay. So to get us out of Washington, we moved to California, took over the business, and I ran it with them for 10 years. So worked the front office, planned funerals for pets. I planned cremations for pets. You name it. There was a lot of different people that came in, but everyone loves their animals, and most more than humans.
Yeah, I would agree.
So it truly was life-changing working in a place like that. But I mean, even though it was sad and often dramatic, there was a lot of love. You could feel the love. Yeah. So everyone's like, oh, it's gotta be so sad working for a pet cemetery. It's like, yeah, but you get to also see like how these pets were cherished. And I'm an animal person. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I will 100% tell you, I am a basket case wreck when my animals pass. So yeah. I can relate. I can understand. But yeah, it was truly an interesting experience.
I love it. I love it. I just think of like a little front desk and like this makeshift fence lined property in the back. And I imagine it's nothing like that, but that's what comes to mind. But mommy, because the scary stories of pet cemetery when I was little too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's amazing. Would you ever, after this career, would you ever go back to owning a pet cemetery?
No.
One and done.
One and done. Okay. One and done. I'm thinking Starbucks barista or something. I don't know. Something stress-free.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Okay. Well, I think that was a great opener. So I know the story that you are going to share with us today. And for my listeners out there, it's a pretty gruesome story. Mm-hmm. Very violent as well. So I'm going to let you take the floor. Okay. And the mic is yours. The studio is yours. So please take it away, Kayla. You have the floor.
Sure. So to kind of intro this story, I like to give a little background about how my current agency works. We're a little bit different than most other agencies. We are a two-person civilian CSI team, and we fall under the umbrella of major crimes. We have essentially three bosses above us. We have a property crime sergeant, a major crime sergeant, and our commander, who's above everybody else. So we have a lot of bosses, but they generally tend to work well together to make sure we're all doing what we need to do and have what we need to have. For this particular scene, it happened in February 2019. I happened to be in Vegas at a California Homicide Investigators Conference with my major crime sergeant and both of my homicide detectives. About 9:15, I get notified by my partner, Tracy, that there is some crazy unknown trouble call. A female is screaming, "My daughter's dead inside an apartment." So we're kind of waiting to see what happens, see how the ball rolls. And not too long after I get the notification, my sergeant gets called by the watch commander and requests us to come back. We now have a active homicide. Patrol had arrived on scene. They had to force entry into the house where they found a male subject walking down the stairs covered in blood. They take him into custody because they don't know what's going on. It's pure chaos. And they clear the apartment and find a deceased female in the kitchen. So the other female that was screaming is now being treated for slashing and stab injuries at the hospital.
And this is the mother?
This is the mother, okay. Yes. So the living victim ends up being the mother.
Gotcha.
Her daughter is the one deceased in the kitchen, and the male subject ends up being the daughter's boyfriend.
And the current boyfriend.
Current boyfriend. Gotcha. So we head back, the 4.5-hour drive. We're trying to decide, like, what are we about to walk into, and what can we prepare for? Now, at this point in my career, I have been with this agency for all of 6 months.
Oh, wow.
I'm new to homicides. I had only done one probably 4 months prior to this, and it was a murder-suicide. So although we worked it the same as we'd work any other homicide, it was non-prosecutable. So we didn't have a suspect that was going to be standing trial.
So that stress factor, right?
Yes. So we could take our time. We could do what we needed to do. It was more of a learning process, mm-hmm. more than anything. But this one was a bigger deal. And prior to me even coming to my agency in September of 2019, they hadn't had a homicide since 2016.
Oh, wow.
So I was the proverbial shit magnet since 2019, essentially.
Official Grim Reaper.
Yes, I am that girl. I apologize to my coworkers profusely. So anyway, so we get to the scene at about 3:20 in the afternoon. My partner, Tracy, she has already processed our living victim, the mom. She has already documented and processed our suspect at our jail.
Okay.
And now I have arrived and she is beginning to FARO or 3D scan the exterior of the apartment and roadway where mom had ran out in the middle of the road. So to give you kind of an idea of how this is laid out, we have a corner apartment. There is one entry and one exit. It's the front door. It leads out to an exterior patio, and then there's a wooden gate that leads out to the street. And it is an extremely busy street. That'll come into play a little bit later. Inside, as you walk inside the apartment, it is a very small loft-style apartment. Right as you walk in, you walk up the stairs. That is the bedroom and bathroom area. There's a walk-in closet up there as well. You walk past the stairs, you have a living room, a small dining room, and then what I consider a galley kitchen with one entry and one exit. So you walk into the kitchen, you hit a wall, you walk back out the same way you came in. The kitchen, when I tell you is small, is very small. It's about 3 feet wide.
Okay.
There's countertops on either side and a bunch of cabinetry. And at the very back of the kitchen on the right side is a refrigerator. So standard, very small, like a beginner starter apartment. I walk in because Tracy and I have talked and she's like, hey, I've got the outside. I'm going to do some documenting and swabbing of things on the outside. How about you start documenting the patio and the interior of the apartment? So great. We are a team. This is how our team functions. We kind of break up duties once we know we can handle them. There are some things that take two of us. But this photographing everything, I can handle that. Again, I'm only 6 months on. So Tracy is very kind of like leery of me doing things by myself, but there needs to be some time efficiency. Like it's busy. They have the roadway closed. They have everything kind of in place, and we don't know how long this is going to take. So I walk in and I notice the initial challenges. Very small spaces. There's blood and what looks, it's just furniture everywhere. It looks like there was a full-on WWE brawl in the middle of the dining room and living room. So I'm trying to document all of these things. And then I walk into the kitchen. I am doing a walkthrough with the detectives that were with me on the drive. So we're kind of all getting this idea all at the same time, like what we need to do, what we've got, those sorts of things. The victim is on the floor in the kitchen, in the rear part of the kitchen. Like there was no way for her to leave. She was stuck where she was. When I tell you that there was blood on almost every single surface, vertical and horizontal, there was. Wow. It was so much blood. It was so violent. So that was another challenge because you don't want to disturb what you have, but you also have to, you've got to navigate somehow, right?
Right.
So she was also covering a lot of evidence items. So now we're like, okay, how do we go about doing collection? Do we do it around her? Do we just wait for her to be removed by the ME? Like those sorts of things. So we had to kind of figure out what we needed to do at that point. We had very little information from initial interviews because my detectives got there at the same time I did. So they were just trying to catch up with the interviews that had already been taken place by some of the other detectives. That's kind of another aspect of our agency is that when some detectives are gone, say the homicide detectives are gone, we have like our sex crimes detectives and our property crimes detectives. We all.
Right. It's a collaborative effort. Yes, like everybody jumps on board.
Come to the scene. So they had already started interviews and everything. They did an amazing job. And then the last challenge was that CSI was split up, right? So I really had to rely on my own training to document as much as I could, process as much as I could without my partner.
She was outside, right?
She was outside, so I could always go ask her for things.
But were you freaking out a little bit?
A little bit. I'm a little bit like, I'm just like, okay, I can't fuck this up. Like, I cannot fuck this up. So, initially, like right out of the gate, I'm taking photos. And I know you know we are very methodical about what we do, right? Photos, evidence, preservation, collection, all that stuff. Very methodical. I'm going through my photos. They're like, hey, we need all the cell phones and the gun upstairs. Okay. Like,
yeah.
Hold on. Let me go get them for you. So my method got a little screwy, gotcha. Right? But I get it. They don't want the phones to die. They don't know what's on them. The firearm, we weren't sure if it was related or not, but we wanted to take it anyway, just in case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 100% sure why. A lot of times we leave firearms at scenes and then we'll collect it all at the end.
Right.
But do you, boo-boo? I didn't really know why.
But they need it right now.
But they need it. They need it right now. So I get all of that done. And at about I don't know, about 8:30 or so, 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the evening. Mind you, this started at 9:07 was our initial call. Tracy comes in and we start measuring and documenting the kitchen and the murder weapons. There was an entire, for the most part, an entire block of kitchen knives used on this poor girl. So we didn't know how many knives we had, but we had broken blades, we had broken handles, we had bent knives, we had so many homicide weapons. Like we were like, okay, there's got to be a method. And we knew we were going to be diagramming.
Right.
Not my favorite thing to do, but we knew we were going to be diagramming. So we were measuring and stuff, trying to strategically place ourselves where we're not, you know, falling in pools of blood.
Right.
So we started doing that. I took multiple photos. I took several rounds of photos just to be sure I got everything. I'm one of those. Like, if I get uncomfortable, I just take, like, 100 more photos than really need be.
But that's what we always say. You can never take enough.
That's how they train,
but
right?
But you can take too little and yes. say, shit.
Yes.
I messed up.
Yes. So we come to the conclusion that she's on too many of the knives to collect everything. So we're going to take what we can out of the way so that when the medical examiner comes to pick her up, they won't be stepping on things or kicking things, all of that. So we start to do our measurements. As we're doing our measurements, I have a property crime sergeant coming in every 20 minutes. And when I tell you I was this close to getting fired that night, because he's just like, how much longer? How much longer? How much longer? How much longer? And I'm like, you have got to stop, because every time you interrupt me, I forget what measurement she just told me. And I'm trying to write all this down. Mind you, this is my first one, so I am like anal retentive when it comes to like all the stuff I'm documenting. So I almost told him off. Luckily, he walked out. So at about 9 o'clock or so, the ME comes and removes our victim's body for transport back to the ME's office, and we start the knife collection and more measuring because now we can see more. And while we were doing that, the detectives asked me, they're like, hey, can you come do a search warrant upstairs? I'm like, is this necessary? Like right now, this is a two-person thing because blood and measuring tapes, and we had our digital one, but we weren't using it for this one. I'm old school, I guess. I don't know. So I'm like, now?
Right.
And so Tracy's like, you know what? I got it. It's just a few more knives. I'll make sure. I'm like, best partner ever. So I go upstairs and start documenting and searching or helping search this room. So at about 9:45 or so, we had called a blood pattern expert to come in just because we had so many different types of blood patterns, and we didn't know if it was going to be irrelevant to our case. So we're like, why not, right? So he comes out and starts analyzing all the stains with Tracy, and he does Amito Black. He develops beautiful footprints, like beautiful. He does such good work. I'm upstairs. I finish. I come down about 1:30 or so. It's decided Kayla can go because she's going to do the autopsy the next morning.
And let me remind listeners, 1:30 a.m.
1:30 a.m., yes.
And we started at 9-ish a.m.? 9
a.m., okay. Yes. And and our medical examiners like to start bright and early at 8:30 in the morning. Every autopsy I've ever been to, 8:30 in the morning. I'm like, ugh, okay. So I'm out. I leave. Tracy stays for another hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes or so, to finish the bloodstain pattern documentation. And then she does a final walkthrough with our sergeant, and then they exit. So at 3:45. So total time on scene for her was about 18 and a half hours. Total time to document all this evidence, photograph everything, do diagrams, do reports was about 3 weeks for this whole case. I went to autopsy the next morning, and normally I think you've probably experienced the same. Normally our autopsies are a couple hours, 2-3 hours, depending on
the severity.
Yeah, 2.5-3 hours.
So this autopsy went from 8:30 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon.
Oh my. Because of the amount of injuries,
yes.
Right?
So she had 99 injuries.
Holy moly.
35 plus stab wounds.
Wow.
And yeah, we ended up having to take a break because the ME dictates for his report all of those wounds. Wow. So it was a very long next day. But we were able to get like an answer at that point, like, oh, this is significant. This isn't a couple wounds. This right. is a lot. So fast forward to trial. It's October 2023. We've done been through COVID, right? and so we're prepping for this case. We are trying to figure out the best way to prep because we have so much evidence. And Tracy starts doing an accounting of all the knives that we have because they want us to present them in court. She compares our knives to our photos and realizes we have missed a broken blade. We do not have it. We're like, oh God, what do we do? We're shitting ourselves. Like, right. what do we do? So I had photographed that blade and then she was left to pick it all up. And it was one of the blades that was not blocked by our victim, but was in a back corner, kind of hidden behind some items, but also where her body was. So it wasn't something you could just reach for.
Gotcha.
You had to wait. So I thought she had seen that. So I didn't mention it. I'm like, what I see is what she sees, right? That was a good takeaway from that because that's not always the case.
Right.
But she hadn't. And neither did our sergeant when they did their final walkthrough. Nobody saw it. So we get to trial. We have let our poor DA know.
Right.
And she's like, oh, okay. Well, the best way is to head it off, like right out the gate, right? So Tracy spent a day and a half on the stand talking about essentially everything. Our DA leaned on her because of her 20 years of experience
right.
in crime scene, leaned on her very heavily. She was able to discuss how we do all of our processing, all of our collection. She was able to say, hey, like it was an oversight. The DA came at us and they're like, why'd you lose a blade? Are you just terrible at your job? And she's like, hold up. Didn't lose it. We know exactly where it is. It's just not with us. Right. So we're human. And that's a big thing that I think DAs forget when they come at us a lot of times, mm-hmm. like trying to discredit us and how we do our job, how well we do our job, is that we're human, just like them.
Right.
Like they're going to make mistakes just like right. we do. And Tracy said, she's like, we're human as much as you. Yeah. So
well, they're just trying to discredit you.
Yeah. And that, and
the jury.
Yeah. And that to us is a sign that, hey, you've got nothing else. Yes. You're just going to try and discredit us.
Grasp okay, straws, go for it.
Okay. Yeah. Fine. They also asked why we didn't do any prints and DNA. The subject had been broached a while back, and it was decided that all three of our subjects were in that apartment quite often. So to have everyone's DNA,
right?
It would be common,
right?
Right. So we didn't do it. We probably should have. It would have eliminated a lot of the defense's line of questioning.
So let me ask you this: looking back, mm-hmm. if you were placed in that situation again, would you have done it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's better, in my opinion. I think it's better to do more and to complete the entire process. You know, things we would normally do any other way.
Yeah.
Because then, yeah, we can say we did it, and yeah. this is what we found. We knew we were going to find this, but this is confirmed. This is how we found it. So there was also so much blood, so much of the victim's blood. We were also like, oh, is it going to dilute
right.
everything else? But you never know. You never knew. We just didn't do it. The defense was very big on downplaying the domestic violence aspect of this. So a little bit of background on this relationship. This suspect has a lot of prior domestic violence that was documented, but he wasn't, he had been arrested before in a previous relationship, But nothing really documented beyond that. It was just within the relationship. Like, his ex-girlfriend said he was a stalker. One kid claimed kidnapping. She got into his car. He got pissed because she was talking to somebody on the phone and wanted to see her phone, and drove off with the door open. She wasn't even trying to get in the car.
Right.
But what else can she do? And then prior to the homicide, in January, so a month and a half before,
right,
she had got a restraining order. Our victim had got a restraining order on our suspect for domestic violence. He had beat her, and then she had to actually jump her gate.
Jeez.
To get out while he was sleeping. So she had an active domestic violence restraining order on this guy, and unfortunately let him back in. And to me, that's kind of the sadder part of things. He's a very manipulative person. He is just a cocky, arrogant, narcissistic asshole. Honestly, even the defense attorney said that in court.
Wow.
Like, I don't even like him. But that doesn't mean he's a murderer. And we're like, what? What? So anyway, so.
How was mom there?
Mom.
Did mom go looking for her daughter, or was mom at daughter's house?
So the way it happened is he had spent the night, woke up, and they had gotten to a fight. She had been texting her mom that morning and then saying that they were fighting or whatever. And then the text stopped. So mom's like, I'm concerned. I'm going to go over there. So she goes over, and daughter answers the door, and she is beat to shit. She has broken nose, a huge black eye. She's bleeding from her face. She's just in a towel.
Jeez.
You know, so they had just gotten out of the shower, I guess. And
he's still in there.
And he's
there.
He's behind our victim when she answers the door. So mom sees her daughter, and is like, you're going to jail, to him. Right. And so what we think happened, we don't know 100% for sure, is that he started dragging our victim by her hair, mm-hmm. and dragging her to the kitchen, while mom is kind of confronting him and trying to get him to stop.
Right.
And she's telling mom to just leave, to just go. But that's her daughter.
Yeah, like, you're not leaving,
right? So he drags our victim into the kitchen, mm-hmm. and puts himself between our victim and mom.
Gotcha.
And then all hell breaks loose. He grabs the knives that are right there by him and just starts wailing. Slices mom in the face because mom's trying to stop him.
Right.
And all she could do, she actually had her phone in her hand, and during this whole altercation had flung it, and it landed in the kitchen. She couldn't get to it.
Oh, shit.
So mom did the only thing she could do. She left. She tried to get help. She's bleeding. She could barely see. And meanwhile, so she triggers it's horrible. So she triggers the Ring video, or the Ring, and you can see mom rushing out, and you can see, or you can hear her daughter plead for her life.
Oh, God.
On that video.
Do they play that in court?
Yes.
Ugh.
Yes. There's also a Ring video that morning before he beat her up. She's in a towel trying to get out, and she can't get her gate open before he drags her back in. The wooden gate. Mind you, remember I said that street is very busy.
Right.
She was running out in nothing but a towel. She was that terrified. And he drug her back in. So that was also played. And the hardest part for all of us was that this guy, thinking he's so cocky, he's going to get off. It was self-defense, this, that, whatever, put this family through this entire case. They saw everything from autopsy photos to those Ring videos. Mom's replaying this over and over and over.
Right.
Like, you're re-victimizing mom, not because you want to, but because you have to get your verdict, right?
Right.
So, despite us not collecting that knife blade, the case was very successful. The trial was very successful, albeit very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
He was sentenced to 37 to life. And I I wish it could have been forever. I don't know that the family is going to get the justice that they want. They want so bad. Mm-hmm. But I 37 to life, and
I mean, he'll never get out.
Yeah, right? he'll never get out. How old is he? He was 22 at the time, 26 when he got sentenced.
Unfortunately, he still has the potential to petition.
He does. Yeah,
at the age of 60 something.
Yes.
Which is not right. Yes. He should have gotten
100%
life.
I think their concern was, and the reason they didn't go, because there was 4 charges against him, and one of them they couldn't substantiate, is that they wanted life or death,
right.
But they were worried they weren't going to get that with a jury. Right. So you go with what you think you can get,
yeah.
And with all the enhancements on top of it. It started with 25 to life, and those enhancements
got it to 37.
Upped it to 37. So, yeah, so it was traumatic. We went to the closing statements, but victim impact statements,
right.
Before sentencing. That was very emotional. Mom stood up and spoke. She stood with her family. She stood up at the podium, but they moved the podium close to her family. She started speaking. Her stepdad, the victim's stepdad, had the closest relationship with our victim. He, even though it wasn't his biological daughter, he loved her like a daughter. Very, very close relationship.
Like her dad.
Yes.
How old was our victim?
Our victim was 24, I think.
Wow. And then how long had he been in her life?
Since she was young, like 7. So he, you know, that was his baby girl, right? And so she, when he had first heard about the whole homicide or whatever, he's like, give me 48 hours with him. That's all I want. In my country, that is what we do. Because he's Middle Eastern descent. So he's on my country. You get 48 hours with him. And then after that, if he lives, he can go to trial. And I'm like, I'm not mad at it. I don't hate it.
I second that.
Yeah.
Your Honor?
So, exactly. So.
Can I get an amen?
So over the 4 years, though, he had become very frail. He'd become very sickly. This just took such a toll on him and mom. Mm-hmm. Mom said she, you know, she couldn't sleep. She couldn't watch violent movies. She couldn't watch. She had a thing about knives now. She sees the scars on her face every day that reminds her of what happened, right? She lives with this guilt that she couldn't do more.
Did they include enhancements on her attack as well? Did
yes.
they bundle it?
Okay, yes. Good. So they did a
245 or attempt homicide?
They were going to attempt homicide. They got the 245.
Okay.
So she was speaking, giving her impact statement, and stepdad, who was in a wheelchair, who had been wheeled in, he actually stood up to console her.
Hmm.
Well, just in front of the podium that they had moved is the table where our suspect and his attorney sat.
Okay.
So not far from the audience.
Right.
So he stands up. We're watching him console her. We're like, you know, at least he's standing. He's doing. All of a sudden, he lunges forward and punches our suspect in the back of the head twice.
Oh,
And of course.
Sorry, I don't condone. Whatever.
I'm mad at it. Like, if that gave him some solace, even though it's not going to
change anything.
Yeah, it didn't injure him in any way. But, I mean, if it gave him that little bit of solace, then okay.
Right.
So, unfortunately, we felt so bad. The bailiff, this young bailiff tackled this poor old man. And we're like, oh, God. We thought he was, like, hurt.
Right.
So they wheeled him out. They made us leave and for like 25 minutes. Then we come in. They had moved our suspect all the way to the end of the jury box, so far away from the audience. So, yeah, that was a little bit of street justice. Something I'd never think I'd ever see in my entire career. But, again, emotions were high. And then, yeah, his dad, the suspect's dad, was in the audience too, and he's making comments. And her family and his family are side-eyeing each other. And I'm just telling Tracy, I'm like, hey, maybe when this is over, we should probably go because they allow everybody to intermingle in the hallway outside. And I don't know who's going to be getting in a fight, but yeah, we don't want to be here for that. So it was a huge case. It was a lot of work. We had a lot of things to contend with, some out of our control, some in our control that just weren't heeded. It was intense.
I would say that's, and this isn't to sound bad, but in the crime scene investigation world, that was a great scene to have, like, your first kind of official homicide.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of dynamics to it.
Mm-hmm.
You had hospital. Did you guys have to go to the hospital at all?
Tracy did.
All right. So you had hospital. Mm-hmm. You had outdoor and indoor. Mm-hmm. You had bloodstain pattern analysis,
mm-hmm.
enhancement that you had to contend with as well.
Mm-hmm.
Small space,
mm-hmm.
very, very long hours,
mm-hmm.
Very violent at that. It's not a straightforward. I mean, we know, all right, boyfriend's probably going to be our suspect, but you don't know what took place here.
Right.
In the situation.
Right.
Did you guys have to process him at all?
Tracy did.
So she processed both.
Yeah. She found small wounds. We think they were self-inflicted on accident.
Okay.
We think, so at the time we didn't know the gun was involved.
Gotcha.
He didn't use it. It was actually locked in a case upstairs.
Okay.
When we got there, the case had been ripped open. It was just a plastic case.
Okay.
The gun had blood all over it.
Okay.
But luckily our victim hid her ammo.
Oh, good.
So she had a small box of ammo in the lower dresser drawer, and he had been searching because that room was torn apart.
Gotcha.
By him. He didn't see it.
Right.
Luckily. And then she had actually filled a magazine with the bullets and put the magazine in a pocket of one of her blazers hanging in the closet.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, the foresight.
Yeah.
The foresight to do that just means that she's terrified anyway.
She I was going to say, do you think that she was...
I think she was concerned he was going to use it on her.
Wow.
And everyone kind of speculates, they thought that he was going to off himself.
Right.
Like, he was going to run upstairs and shoot himself, but he couldn't find the bullets. And I was like, you know, I would normally believe that, but this guy is such a narcissistic piece of shit that, like, he probably would go on a shootout before he actually shot himself.
He was probably either going to sound like excessive overkill.
Yes.
I mean, you use one knife, but to use all the knives?
Yes.
And then maybe he was looking for the gun to take it to the next level.
You know, yeah.
Put a bullet in her.
Or mom. Or, yeah.
Or whoever else was going to come
yes.
for him. So like you said, like shootout.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to go down without a fight.
Yeah. He locked the door, locked mom out. Walked the front door and ran upstairs, and that's when he started. So we don't 100% know. I don't think he ever said.
Right, you can never.
Yeah, but
to infer.
But yeah, it was one of those where it's like, what are you gonna do with that, sir? But yeah, so there was a lot of stuff to contend with, a lot of different elements and people.
Oh my gosh,
the amount of people.
So
at that scene.
With that being said. Big learning lessons on these mm-hmm. major first homicides for us. And mm-hmm. I know you're going to look back in like 10 years from now, you know, this is one you're going to probably go back to a lot
100%.
And learn a lot mm-hmm. from. So give me like two things or three things that you definitely would have liked seen done differently, whether from you guys, personally, you and Tracy, what you would have done different
mm-hmm.
On the crime scene side of things
mm-hmm.
and what you would have. Let's start there, and then we'll transition what you would have asked of your command staff, your chain of command would have done different.
So as far as me and Tracy, I would have liked to work more alongside her. The 3D scanning and the farrowing is, you know, you learn it over time if that's something that your CSI unit does. So I wasn't too concerned with that, but I leaned on her a lot for her expertise. I am one of those people, if you've been in the industry for a while, you're my go-to. If I have a question, just like you,
right.
you've been doing this for so long, like anything that you tell me, I am going to absorb because you've seen way more than me. You've dealt with way more than me. So at that time and at that moment, Tracy was my person. And even if it was just to reassure me that I was doing what I was supposed to be doing based on all the stuff I've learned, it would have been a little bit more reassuring. I probably would have been a little bit more confident in what I was doing. And I probably wouldn't have taken so long to do some things or focus on some things as much. But she's also very good about saying, like, do whatever you think you need to do, because at the end of the day, you're going to be the one testifying. Exactly. So if it makes sense for you to do things a certain way or doing more than you should, that's fine. Right. Like, that's how you learn. That's how you experience things. So yeah, working along with her, getting her opinions on certain observations, certain evidence. She thinks a little differently than me because, again, she's seen more than I have.
Right.
So, like, sometimes she'll say things. I'm like, I didn't even think about that.
Well,
okay. Yeah. So as far as that aspect, that was a big one for us. And then, obviously, being together, collecting evidence, making sure we got everything.
Right.
Because, to me, that's – although we're human, that's still something that probably shouldn't have happened.
Right.
And there was a lot of people that – saw or, you know, went through that scene and still didn't see.
Right.
So being able to be together to do those things, I think was hugely important that, you know,
that
obviously didn't happen.
That yes. final walkthrough together.
Yes. Right. Yes. So, and then as far as command staff, I mean, the constant interruptions drive me crazy. I am one of those, if I'm in the zone,
right.
Don't break that. Like I'm doing what I need to do, what makes sense to me. And if you're coming in asking me, like, how much longer? And I know it's a CSI thing. This is across the board. This isn't my agency alone.
Right.
And I get why they do it, because there's a lot of resources that are going on while you process this scene.
Right.
So there's a lot of things that they need timing on so that they can make sure they've got coverage. They're going to keep the road closed. They're going to do a SIG alert. They're going to, you know, all of those things. So I get why they do it, but limit it to one person. We had so many bosses at that scene asking a ton of us. And there's just two. There's just me and her. Right. So that's a big thing. And I think that goes for any scene we're at. I think they've gotten a lot better about it, especially these recent ones.
Good.
So we have one source of contact generally. It's our major crime sergeant. And he's pretty good about letting us know, or he'll come in and be like, hey, when you're done, can you come check in with me?
Right.
The only other thing because communication's huge, right? In our industry, are being able to talk to each other, checks and balances, making sure our questions are asked and answered, being able to get updates after interviews are done. Like, that didn't happen in this case. Me and Tracy worked. We barely stopped for food. And
do you think that you could have held the scene?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think you would, if this happened again, would you recommend? Because, I mean, I know Tracy's pushing up that 18-hour mark,
mm-hmm.
but, like, pure exhaustion sets in,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to miss things.
Mm-hmm.
It just is what it is. And I'm not saying that's why you miss the knife, but there's you're just going to forget things and miss things.
Right.
So would you feel comfortable with your department saying, look, we want to work up to this point, but can we hold the scene? Sleep, come tomorrow morning, even the autopsy, you know, or just have one mm-hmm. person at least with some daylight and a couple more hours of sleep and some food.
Yes. I think taking those breaks is very important. Even if it's a food break, like we don't just, I don't know if you guys are the same way. We work, like we work until someone tells us to stop.
Yeah. We usually work until they're like, we got food and party wants to eat, but it's like,
you're right in the middle.
Like I'm in the zone.
Yeah.
And I can't stop.
Yeah. But yes, in this case, we could have easily held it till the next day. I think their biggest issue was the roadway and getting all that done. And we had documented that was done by like 9 o'clock. You can open the road. We're good.
Yeah.
But again, with all the bosses and all of their own opinions about things, like now you've got commanders and sergeants going like,
right.
like butting heads about what they want to do and how they want to handle this. And when it should have just been one sergeant, one commander. So, yes, I think that scene, it could go either way. I think it would have been helpful to hold it, though, once once we got to a stopping point, we could have blood pattern come out the next day, because that always takes a very long time.
Yes.
So it would have been fine. But
that's what I think. Yeah, I was thinking.
They like to, they're a one and done kind of thing. Like, they're like, we're wrapping this up as fast as possible. I'm like, why are we rushing?
So as far as the aftermath, like, once the scene was done, was there constant communication from your detectives after that, building up to court, going over evidence or coordinating anything?
No. Okay. No, unfortunately. Once we got done, we got all of our stuff in, it was kind of out of sight, out of mind until trial started. And then we worked a lot with our district attorneys. Okay. I mean, Tracy communicated with our detectives as far as like the knife being left behind and certain aspects of it. But for the most part, the DA relied heavily on her and what was collected, because at the end of the day, it's a forensics case, right? I mean, you have his interview and his testimony, and he's not doing himself any favors, but he's also not really helping us. So we have to kind of rebuild the scene. I have an analogy I always use. Like, we're working a puzzle from the middle out. Right. We don't have any edges. We have this scene. We don't have any information surrounding it for the most part.
Right.
And nothing intricate, nothing, you know, specific. And now we're trying to build it out to make this giant picture. And it took a lot of time. It took the videos. It took witness statements. It took, statements from his past, girlfriends, those things, to really build this picture of how this guy is and why this is not shocking behavior, unfortunately. Right. So I think it's just one of those things. Like, and I know, again, this is not agency specific, but communication lacks in some areas. We are also kind of away from our detective bureau. We don't work within our detective bureau. Okay. We have our lab, like a small little lab, and our office is on the complete other side of the building. Gotcha. So sometimes we're an out of sight, out of mind kind of unit. But if we need something, or if, you know, we have information to share, we will by all means go do that. So trial prep was more with the DA, really.
All right. So not crime scene related in the sense of the technical stuff, but if you wanted to share one lesson you learned, or you would want our listeners to learn from this type of scene, whether if you sit back and reflect on who the victim was, who the suspect was, how the scene unfolded, like, if our listeners can take away one thing from this, what would you want them to know?
Communicate with your team. Don't be scared to ask questions. Don't be scared to ask for an update. Again, I'm 6 months on to this agency, so I know a lot of newer people aren't going to be as comfortable with their command staff, or even other detectives, or even sometimes the other CSIs, just because they don't really know how they can be around them, at what questions they can ask. So don't be afraid, though. This is your reputation. This is your job. This is what you need to do. And if you have certain information that you need, or you want to update on the interviews, how they went, what did they say specifically, ask it. Don't be afraid to ask. It could be uncomfortable, but it's going to help you do your job better.
Right.
So that's probably the biggest thing that I took away from this. Now I just say what I want and they get really annoyed with me and whatever. I don't care. I don't care.
You want me to do my job good? Respect me. I'm going to ask my questions. You're going to listen.
Exactly. Exactly.
I like it. And for my listeners out there, like, and I know other crime scene investigators, and even for you people out there that are not crime scene investigators, unfortunately, like, it's a very, very sad case, a very violent case. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that obviously there was some foreshadowing by our victim. Unfortunately, you know, she had this firearm and she had the ammunition stored another place, and she had the magazine in her coat pocket. Mm-hmm. I felt like she knew what she was in store for, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, she just could not not keep him away from her. And So to all my listeners out there, if you experience any sort of domestic violence in relationships, those restraining orders really don't work, unfortunately. No. It takes a village to protect yourself, protect the ones you love. And I don't know, like, how could she have changed the situation? She would have had to take some very drastic measures, maybe change the phone, change where she lived, completely get rid of all communication from him.
Yeah, which is very difficult.
Because it's so difficult.
Because he would show up and she, restraining order or not, she wouldn't. He's a narcissist.
Yeah, so he worked his way in.
He's very persuasive. He's, I love you, baby. You're my everything. I don't mean to hurt you. I'm sorry I hurt you. Like,
and they're so young.
Yes.
They were so young dealing with this very, very traumatic, violent relationship at such a young age. And I mean, at all ages, they can experience this. We can experience this. But, you know, being a mom and thinking of my daughters being in a violent relationship one day, shit.
Nope.
I wish mom would have showed up with a fucking shotgun, you know?
You do.
You know, like, gosh.
You do. Like, you know, from the outside looking in, you never want to judge a victim. But, like, you can see it. When this picture of him started to get built, like, you can see why she did what she did. A lot of people are like, wow, she had a restraining order. Why didn't she call the cop? Like, when you're dealing with somebody like he is, sometimes it doesn't matter. Like, he does not care. Right. He will go to jail. He absolutely doesn't care. And he, you know, like you said, they're very young. So cutting off all communication, changing your phone number, that's drastic. That is very difficult for younger people to do. She did change her location. She got this apartment alone.
Right.
And, you know, she moved him in. And so it's, you don't ever want to judge her, but a lot of people do. And it wasn't all her,
you know,
it was not all her. And he is just that kind of guy. And it's terrible to see. And it's terrible to see the trend throughout all of his past relationships. Right. Like, this was coming.
His parents there. I wonder how they're, you know,
they were talking so much shit about her and her family.
Gosh.
It was disgusting. And they were, unfortunately, there was the room in the courtroom. We had to sit behind them, and some of the comments that were made, and they were disgusting. I'm like, you just sat through this whole trial and you saw what your son did, and you still
stand behind him,
still stand behind him and make him feel like, oh, this wasn't his fault. She had a part in it. Like, I'm sorry.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Those are the frustrating parts of our.
Yes. those makes us question humanity sometimes. Because he had to learn it somewhere, though, I guess.
Right.
But.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing your crime scene story.
Of course.
I hope you guys enjoyed it out there. I'll be back soon with a new recording. So please tune in. I'll be dropping this probably tonight. I get my manager to edit. All right. I love you all. Once again, this is the Wild Zoo Talk True Crime Podcast. Take care and I'll see y'all soon. Bye. Hey, it's Gabrielle. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to like, subscribe, and share. And visit me at thewallsdotalk.com. We look forward to hearing from you.